I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Our guest, Binyamin Applebaum, Washington correspondent for The New York Times, says that he became interested in an overlooked statistic, the employment rate that measures the share of Americans who are working. And while the unemployment rate has fallen in recent years, Applebaum noticed that the employment rate has remained largely unchanged during the same time period. He dug deeper and found that the rate of employment for men has been falling for almost 50 years. We asked him to join us on Radio Times to discuss his findings and his recent story titled The Vanishing Male Worker. Binyamin Applebaum, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be with you.
So is the unemployment rate a misleading rate?
I think it has a sort of misleading name. What the unemployment rate actually measures is the share of Americans who are actively looking for work. It does not count all of the people who are out of work. And what we've seen in recent years is that it has declined in large part, not because a lot of people have found jobs, but because a lot of people have stopped looking and left the workforce entirely.
In fact, you found that 16% of men 25 to 54, and these are the prime working years, 16% of men are not working, and that's triple since the 1960s. Break that apart for us.
Yeah, this is a group that, you know, is in its prime, and almost all of them used to be working. At any given moment, you know, basically more than 9 in 10 of them were working, and most of the others were looking for work, and it was very unusual for a man of that age to be sitting at home or to have given up on finding a job, and that has become increasingly common. During the recession, it reached a peak at about 1 in 5 prime-age men who were simply not working. It's fallen a little bit since then, but the long-term trend is steadily downwards. As you say, it's tripled since the 1960s. More and more of these men say that they are unable to work for physical reasons, or that they have decided to retire early, or that they are, you know, at home taking care of kids or taking care of the house. They are making choices other than working, in part because finding good jobs has become extremely difficult for them.
Do you think this is unique to the United States?
It is very interesting that if you go back a generation, the United States had one of the highest rates of workforce participation, both male and female. And over that last generation, we have fallen toward the bottom among developed nations. So we are seeing something different happen here than is happening in other countries. There's obviously been a global economic downturn, and to some extent that has reduced the share of adults who are working in most developed countries. But something broader is happening in the United States, and it is something that is particular to the United States.
You profile a number of men in this article, and for a number of them, perhaps these are people that lost their jobs during the recession. From their perspective, a $10 an hour job just is not worth it, I should say. Help us understand their thinking.
So this is one of the most striking things that we've found. You know, there's sort of an instinct to think that the share of men who are not working are primarily out of work, either because they simply cannot work, perhaps because of a disability, or because they cannot find jobs. And in fact, many of these men fall into a broad gray area where the issue is much more complicated than that. It is in part the case that many of them have injuries of some kind that perhaps make it a little bit harder to work. Many of them lack the skills necessary to get the best jobs. But one of the most interesting things is that some of them say flat out, and we found about half of unemployed men say this, that there are jobs in their area that they could get, but that they are unwilling to take. And people will ask, you know, why wouldn't a person prefer to make $10 an hour rather than zero? And broadly speaking, there seem to be two reasons. The first is that $10 an hour isn't all that it's cracked up to be. For a lot of these guys, by the time you've gotten to work, you've paid for the car, you've paid for the gas, you've paid for the uniform, you're not really bringing home that much money at the end of the day. And there is also an issue of identity and pride for a lot of these guys, a sense that that kind of work is beneath them, and that, you know, people who worked in construction or manufacturing or came out of the military, the idea of being on public display as a retail clerk or a McDonald's counter worker, it's just something they find difficult to stomach. And so far, they've been able to get by without doing it.
And I want to pick up on that. I did a little bit of math. So $10 an hour gross is something like $20,000 a year. I don't know if that qualifies as poverty or not, but that is, you know, that's not the greatest salary in the world.
Yeah, and for many of these men, it's less than, I mean, $10 an hour is sort of an idealized figure. That's right. Higher than the minimum wage in most areas. For a lot of the guys, the reality is that they'd be making even less than that. And after taxes and after expenses, it ends up being, I mean, certainly if you have a family that you're trying to support, it's essentially impossible to do that on $10 an hour. And if you're living alone, it can still be a difficult proposition.
But unemployment, you know, that goes away after a certain period of time. How are these men surviving?
Almost none of them are on unemployment benefits. That's a very important point. Less than 2% of the men in our survey reported that they were receiving unemployment benefits. If you've been out of work for more than half a year, you essentially have exhausted the availability of those benefits. You know, people are patching together livelihoods. They do it, you know, government benefits. The federal disability program is helping a lot more men than it used to. A lot of people have perhaps chosen to fall back on that safety net. People rely on friends and family. Many of them work odd jobs. There's a lot of evidence that a certain share of people who are not engaged in the workforce are involved in the illegal economy, dealing drugs or participating in other types of black market activities. But for a lot of these men, you know, it's a fairly bare bones existence. I talked with men who have moved in with parents or friends, or a man in Minneapolis, St. Paul, who has, you know, negotiated a deal with his landlord to pay a small amount of money each month in exchange for doing work around the building, or a man who has moved in with a blind relation who receives disability. He doesn't pay any rent. He helps her around the house. They share food, and he gets by. A lot of stories like that of men who are really trying to patch together an existence.
Are we talking about men who are pretty depressed about their lives?
It's interesting. You know, we asked men a series of questions about how being out of work has affected them. We asked about their physical health, their relationship with friends and family, their activity in the community. The number one impact that men reported was that this has hurt their mental health. Mm. They are upset about this, unhappy about being out of work, depressed about being out of work. This is also a recurring theme in my conversation with these men. They hate it. They do not like their lives. They are not happy about this situation. None of them, you know, reported being overjoyed about, you know, this situation that they're in.
You say an interesting thing, though, and perhaps this just sort of reflects some changes in our economy, is that for some of these men, we're speaking very broadly here, there might be fewer responsibilities for children or even for a marriage, that they're probably less married than their counterparts of previous generations.
This is a really important point. It has become easier for a lot of men to get by without working. And it's not primarily because the government is providing a larger safety net, although the federal disability program has expanded. It's because for a lot of these men, they don't have dependents. They are much less likely to be living in a household with a partner or with children there. They're not less likely to have children, but they're less likely to be providing directly for those children. More and more children are growing up in households with a single mother who has responsibility for them. And so for a lot of these men, there's less demand. There's some very interesting work that's been done about the way in which getting married and starting a family historically sort of pushed men to engage in the workforce and to start trying to earn a living. And in the absence of that dynamic, many of them are perhaps less motivated to participate. It should be noted that it may be the case that they are unable to find work and therefore unable to, you know, convince women to form partnerships with them. The causation is a little bit tangled, but the situation is clear. Many fewer of them are in households, many fewer of them are working, and because they're not providing for a larger group of people, it's easier for them to get by.
So how do they occupy their time all day and night?
It's fascinating. You know, about half of the time that men spent working, they say that they now spend in one of two ways, either sleeping or in passive leisure activities like watching television or playing video games. The rest of the time is sort of a mix of things, errands, you know, education, housework. But a lot of the time that they previously spent working is essentially, you know, wasted or absorbed by sleep and television.
We're going to spend some time after we say goodbye to you, Binyamin, talking about women and work, but some interesting research about how men, and again, broadly speaking, spend their time if they're out of work and how women spend that time. And it's different.
It's very different and it's very striking. Men One of my favorites, one of, I think, the most revealing findings from this survey is that men and women both report that they're much more likely to spend time with their children if they have children. Women report that that's a really good thing, that they think it has improved their relationship with their children. Men report the opposite. They say that it has been bad for their relationship with their children. And as best we can understand it, that's because the men are more likely to see themselves as breadwinners and as role models, and if they're not working, they feel like they're not fulfilling those responsibilities. They're not playing that role properly. So it's really interesting. In general, women appear to have greater comfort with being out of work. It is easier for them to find an identity outside of work, and they are, in general, less willing or less able to make sacrifices to return to work. Men say that they'll commute long distances, move to different cities, switch fields, at much higher work nights and weekends. All these things they're much more willing to do than women. Women are less likely to do those things, less likely to take a significant pay cut. They clearly place a higher value on the alternative lives outside of work than men do. And report as well, you know, sort of less of a psychological impact. They're much more likely to spend their time, you know, doing constructive things like volunteering or participating in the community or exercising or all of these things women do at much higher rates than men when they're out of work.
In fact, you say that men spend, as you said, watching television, but also online. And I guess, I mean, the internet is a connection to the outside world, a digital connection, but nonetheless a connection.
This is fascinating to me. I encountered a number of economists who argue basically that, you know, while in general we think of the cost of living as steadily increasing, in some important respects, life may actually be getting cheaper. And one of the most important is sort of the cost of, you know, having a social life and establishing relationships and making links with other people, that the internet, unemployment, you know, was once a very lonely condition, being home alone. It was an isolating and difficult condition, but internet access can alleviate some of that. And there's, you know, a lot more people are forming relationships, finding partners online, and you know, for unemployed men as well, this offers an outlet and an opportunity where, you know, once a guy needed a job to have a car to, you know, take a woman out on Friday night, the internet can sort of short-circuit some of that, and there's the interesting suggestion that it has made life in that way cheaper for men and a little bit more tenable, even if they don't have jobs.
Let's take a very short break, Benjamin, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Benjamin Applebaum. He's a correspondent for the New York Times, and we're talking about a recent article that he had titled "The Vanishing Male: Why Some Men Are Opting Out of Employment." We're going to take a very short break. Open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be talking with Benjamin for another 10 minutes or so. Then Judith Levine from Temple University and Jerry Jacobs from the University of Pennsylvania will describe how women are navigating the responsibilities of work and family. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Benjamin Applebaum, correspondent for the New York Times, talking about his recent article about the vanishing male, the title of the article, Why Some Men Are Opting Out of Employment. As he reported, based on some research, about 16% of men 25 to 54 are not working, tripling since the 1960s. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. And again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Benjamin, do you see this as an aberration, or are we something? Are we talking about something more a more permanent part of our employment picture in this country?
It seems clear that this is not an aberration. I mean, it's been going on for half a century, and it has been, you know, fairly steady that each time we go into an economic downturn, we lose a portion of our workforce, and each time we come out of it, we regain only some of those losses. So the downward trend is clear and long-term, and it has long-term causes. It is a product in part of shifts in the types of workers that can find jobs. We've seen a hollowing out of the middle of the workforce. Job growth has been primarily in high-end jobs that require an education, or in low-end jobs in industries like retail and other service industries, the sort of, you know, Detroit auto worker who could make a middle-class living with a high school education, that entire section of the economy has gone away, and the people, predominantly men, who filled those roles find themselves unable to secure replacements. You know, men with high school education who want to earn a middle-class living are having a harder and harder time in this country. So that's one long-term trend. We've talked about some of the others as far as changes in the social fabric that may be making it less likely for men to work as well. But it is clear that this erosion it predates this recession. It has no immediate cause, and it's unlikely to reverse, at least easily or quickly.
And there are global pressures as well, are there not?
It is certainly the case that one reason we've seen such an erosion of our manufacturing base is globalization, lower cost competition from foreign countries. We've also seen, you know, growing role for technology in these industries. The idea that robots are replacing workers is clearly true, at least in part, and it is playing a role in some of this as well.
Let me get to it. Looks like Cameron from Center City, Philadelphia, to join our conversation. Hi, Cameron. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
So, you know, it sounds like gender roles have a large impact on this, how men see their role in society. And obviously, gender roles have changed a large amount. With millennials now flooding this, do you see an effect for age?
See an effect for age. The idea, Benjamin, that depending on what age you are at more risk for not being able to get back into the workforce?
So it is clear
I'm sorry, Cameron, go ahead.
I was going to say, or just rather how you perceive your free time when you're not employed, when you're, you know, as we were discussing, how you see your time otherwise.
Okay. Let me see if Benjamin can respond. Your thoughts?
So it is clear that this is concentrated among older men. This has been particularly difficult for older men. They have, you know, they're often further along in their careers. It's harder to adapt. There's some evidence that employers, you know, tend to prefer younger workers. And so men who are in their late 40s or early 50s, you know, they're the ones who are experiencing this in the greatest numbers. And so it is concentrated at that end of the spectrum. As to whether pride plays a greater role, sort of a sense of male identity plays a greater role, that's a very interesting question. We didn't look at that in terms of whether that has changed over time. There is good research showing that this is a class distinction as much as an age distinction, that, in other words, that changes in gender dynamics have occurred much more at sort of the upper end of the income spectrum. Gender identities have remained rather more constant among families that make less money. And so it may be that that's the more important dynamic. But we did not look at it in this particular study.
Cameron, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But Benjamin, I'm thinking about that, let's say, 52-year-old man who is not working, but he's going to be eating into whatever savings he has. And let's say he lives to, what, 80, 85 years old. We're talking about a shrinking financial package for this person.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, one of the things that I think some people saw in this survey that is easy to overstate is that a large number of the people in the survey basically said, you know what, I'm getting by. It's okay. This isn't great, but I have enough to get by. And the question, which you just put perfectly, is, will that still be true in a decade or in two decades? Mm-hmm. You know, if you've got 50-year-olds who are starting to dig into their retirement savings, you know, the man I profiled in the lead of my story, a 49-year-old who has drained all $15,000 from his retirement account to make it for the last 2 years, you know, he's getting by right now, but there are not $15,000 in his retirement account anymore. What happens when he's 60? What happens when he's 65? That's a real question, and it is totally plausible to me that the long-term effect of this will be very significant, and that a lot of these guys are going to find that even if they can sort of patch everything together at the moment, that's going to be harder and harder to do as they get older.
Is this an argument for a living wage beyond $10 an hour, but more like $15 an hour? Would that get some of these men back to work?
Well, it seems clear that the men themselves would prefer that. I mean, they say that, you know, overwhelmingly they say that if jobs were available at higher wages, they would jump at those opportunities. There's some complexity, you know, if you impose higher minimum wages, particularly large increases in the minimum wage. There are some economists who think that has the effect of reducing the number of jobs that are available. because if employers need to pay each individual more, they're likely to hire fewer of them. So the total economic effects of doing something like that are complicated. But it is interesting. There's sort of a broad standoff happening here between employers who are basically saying, we want you, but we only want you at $10 an hour, and potential workers who are saying, we'd like to work for you, but not at $10 an hour. It has the feel kind of a economy-wide lockout, and it is going to be really interesting to see which way that is resolved, whether as the economy continues to strengthen, employers find it is worth their while to start paying higher wages to lure workers back, or whether workers, increasingly desperate for whatever money they can make, start caving in and accepting $10 an hour. The general pattern in recent decades has been that all of the leverage is with employers. We've seen this broad pattern where more and more of a business's earnings go to the owners of the business and less to the workers, sort of a broad collapse of bargaining power for workers. And, you know, if you were betting, you'd probably bet that that pattern continues and that it is the workers who are ultimately forced to come back at lower wages. But there's no question that they'd be happier if the number was 15 rather than 10.
Benjamin, final question for you. Are there enough jobs to go around? Forget the salary, just the actual number of jobs?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely
not.
That's
a very important point. Absolutely not. I mean, you know, there are about 10 million of these men out there in their prime years, most of whom say that they'd like to be working. There are, in the most recent federal data, only 4.9 million positions for workers of all ages. So, I mean, it should not. These long-term trends are very important, but we shouldn't lose sight of the fact of the basic reality that our economy is still in a very weak place, and that the sort of the most important, relevant of the moment fact is that we are not producing enough jobs to keep everyone busy right now, and the economy has not fully recovered from the financial crisis.
Well, Benjamin Applebaum, thank you once again for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And he's Washington correspondent for The New York Times. And we were talking about the declining rate of employment for men, what that means for the family and for the country. And now we want to focus on women and work, how they balance family and the job, and how their counterparts in Europe compare when it comes to policies like childcare and maternity leave. And we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Judith Levine is an associate professor of sociology at Temple University, wrote a book earlier this year called Ain't No Trust, How Bosses, Boyfriends, and Bureaucrats Fail Low-Income Mothers and Why It Matters. Judith Levine, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Wonderful to be here.
And also with us is Jerry Jacobs. He's a professor of sociology at the University of Pennsylvania and founding president of the Work and Family Researchers Network. Jerry Jacobs, thanks for joining us, and thanks for coming back on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. You both were listening very intently as Benjamin Applebaum was talking and taking notes. Anything you want to say, Judith, before we get into the whole world of women and work?
Well, it just makes very clear that while there's a huge inequality between women and men, that we should not be rejoicing over how men are doing. Both are really hurt in the current economy.
You agree with that, Jerry?
Yes, but I wanted to make one slightly brighter note.
No, go ahead.
Which is that the fact that many women are working creates a kind of diverse portfolio for families. So in a sense, there's insurance. 80% of unemployed individuals, people who are classified as unemployed by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, in 80% of those families, there's somebody else working, okay? Most often the wife, but sometimes another family member. And so when you have that kind of situation where if somebody's unemployed, somebody else can help cover things until things pick up a little bit, that's not nearly as bleak a situation.
No, and I think that's a very important point. Judith, would it be fair to say that there are sort of different trajectories then for men and women at work, maybe even biological trajectories? Are there?
Well, it's certainly true that we have yet, while Jerry's absolutely right, that women have filled a gap by moving into the labor market, Men have been slower to fill the gap at home by moving into doing everything that needs to be done to take care of a household and children. And men have certainly increased their efforts in this area, but still there's a lot of inequality. And because of that, there are pressures on women when they try to balance employment and home life that are just not quite as strong for men.
And explain that, and then we'll get Jerry back in.
We still, as a society, sort of expect mothers to do the bulk of the work. And when kids get sick in the middle of the day, it is more likely the mother who gets the call and has to figure it out and often leave. It taxes the home more when mothers travel, when mothers work long hours. So a lot of women have the pressure of having to figure that out that isn't quite on men.
You know what's so interesting, and this is actually going back to another New York Times article, Jerry Jacobs, which is just comparing the kinds of family benefits from this country, countries like Britain, countries like France, where women are, I guess parents are, but women are given a year's largely paid leave once they have a child. You don't, except for perhaps the most generous company here, that doesn't really happen in this country.
Right. Paid leave is the exception rather than the rule, certainly in terms of government policy. California has had a very limited duration and very limited benefit levels for paid family leave for some time, but they're kind of leading the country in that respect. What paid leave does is enable women to leave the labor market for a period of time and then come back in, often with the same company. But what's also interesting is, as you were saying, it's a parental leave in Europe, especially in the Scandinavian countries. And so there are places where there's kind of use it or lose it policies for the father. Mm-hmm. If they don't take the leave, it's not transferred to the mother. And so there's a concerted effort to get fathers more involved in taking care of kids, and it's paying off.
But why do you think this country is so, shall I say, stingy when it comes to family benefits for working families?
I think the immediate issue is, at the moment, is a reluctance to get involved in labor regulations at all. And so whether we want paid sick leave or paid family leave or just better regulations for workers' health and safety or increasing the minimum wage, the conservative opposition to getting any involvement in the labor market, I think, is the key stumbling block at the moment.
Well, and I'm sure people listening, Judith, that maybe have a company listening to us are saying, I can't afford to do all these benefits. I can't afford to keep someone's job open. I can't afford, you know, sick leave, all the kinds of things, all the kind of benefits that could help a family.
Absolutely. And employers, are right to be concerned about those costs. I think they also should have a longer-term view. There are certainly costs in turnover of the workforce, and often a lot of really good female workers are lost because they just can't work out this relatively short period in their lives when in the long term they would be very committed employees. Another thing that's going on, of course, is just a much bigger picture of the U.S. welfare state compared to European welfare states. In the U.S., we are kind of the land of individualism, and we think of people who choose to have a child. That's an individual choice, that children are, excuse how this sounds, a consumption item, are a luxury. And in Europe, children are seen as a societal good, especially because the birth rate is declining in many European countries, and they need children. So it's not just out of the goodness of their hearts. There's also that incentive. But the European welfare states are supporting parenthood, motherhood, women staying in the labor market because they have a pro-child view.
I mean, and it is interesting, Jerry, to think of this short-term and long-term, whether the long-term benefits of all of that would outweigh some of the short-term costs.
Well, the researchers in the work family area are very focused on that business case for work and family policies. And they're there's a lot of studies that show that there's less turnover, as you mentioned, but also more engagement with work, more commitment, more loyalty to a particular company. And so you can justify as an employer, whether or not the government does anything, as an employer, you can certainly make a business case for having family-friendly policies. Your workers are less exhausted. They're less distracted. They're
more loyal, I would think.
They're more loyal. They make fewer mistakes. But it's also important to keep in mind that there's kind of a bifurcation in the labor market. There are highly educated women who are kind of on a career track. And the issue there is, what are the stumbling blocks for them getting ahead and taking leadership positions and running companies and so on? For less educated women, workplace flexibility is first and foremost about being able to take off a few hours to go to a parent-teacher meeting or what have you, and inadequate benefit coverage, not having health care, not having retirement benefits. So the employment picture is really different for women versus other mothers, mothers versus other women, and less educated and more educated women.
And we're almost up on a break here, but childcare, I mean, that in many ways, that is the sort of make or break for
a huge issue. And childcare is very expensive. And for low-income women, the childcare may be more expensive than their wage.
Really?
So so this is a problem.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We began the hour talking about the world of work for men. Again, and our guest was Binyamin Appelbaum, who had an interesting article in the New York Times recently about the vanishing male worker. Joining us now, Judith Levine, Associate Professor of Sociology at Temple University, author of a book called Ain't No Trust. Also with us, Jerry Jacobs. He's a professor of sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a founding president of the Work and Family Researchers Network. We are talking about work and family. We want to hear from you what you would like at your workplace. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We want to hear from employers and workers alike. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Jerry Jacobs and Judith Levine about women in the world of work and balancing the responsibilities of work and family. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Judith, during the hour, we've been sort of comparing and contrasting what it's like for families to work in this country and what it's like for them to work in Europe. And in this country, you get, what, 3 months unpaid
right. So
leave.
We had no leave of any kind until 1993 on the federal level when Clinton passed the FMLA, the Family Medical Leave Act. And that gives women or men 3 months, 12 weeks of unpaid, let's stress unpaid, leave to take care of a new child or a health issue for yourself or a immediate family member, not your grandparents, not your same-sex partner unless you're married to your partner. But I think what people don't understand is that 40%, or in some estimates a little over 40%, of the labor force isn't even covered by the FMLA because it doesn't cover you if you work for a place that has fewer than 50 workers. You have to work a certain number of weeks out of the year. You have to work a certain number of hours. Lots of low-income people don't have those kinds of hours, and they piece together they work full-time by working three different jobs, but then none of those jobs qualify. So lots of people get no leave compared to, as you said, the European Germany, Norway, France, Finland offer 3 years with a good bit of it paid. So
3 years?
Yes.
3 years?
Yes. Now, of course, that creates other problems.
I was going to say.
We can get to because suddenly women are seen as really costly to hire. And so there are some disemployment effects. But back to the U.S., low-income people are really have no leave. So in my book, which is based on qualitative interviews with low-income women, and we should, you know, stress it's not a scientific representative sample, but it's interesting to note that the very most common reason for women to leave work is pregnancy. Mm. So the way to leave their job, and the way they get maternity leave is by leaving one job and then when they're done being home with their kid, finding another. You know, maybe 6 weeks later. But a lot of their jobs wouldn't allow them 6 weeks to be home. Women who have very dire health situations in their families often lose their jobs. One mother lost her job when she went to visit her dying mother, who died within a couple of days. Mm. Her boss said, if you go, you can't come back. And she went, and she came back, and the boss was true to her word. Another woman left work without informing her. She left a note on her boss's desk because she couldn't find her boss when her daughter was hit by a car and was in the ER. And the next day when she came back, she was terminated. So we really don't have protections for low-income workers.
Well, and I wonder to you, Jerry, more perhaps middle-class or maybe even professional women, is it a variation on what Judith just said, or is it that they have more resources so they can afford childcare, maybe even a nanny in the home?
The work-family situation is quite different. For middle-class or professional or managerial jobs, it's really more a matter of time demands and pressure at work. So there's more flexibility on a personal basis. A lot of middle-class workers can work at home occasionally one day a week. There's more flexibility to run to the emergency room if that's necessary. But the flip side is that jobs are more demanding. There's often more travel involved. And it's often more mm-hmm. difficult to juggle work and family. A lot of women opt out of the labor market, but they often want to opt back in fairly quickly after that, and often find it's mm-hmm. it's difficult to get back to the same place they were or to get back on any kind of ladder.
You know, it was interesting talking with Benjamin Applebaum about some of this research. It's Kaiser looked at men at work. And I'll put this to you, Jerry, which is that men seem to have a harder time figuring out sort of how to manage their day if they weren't working, whereas women seem to be able to schedule in activities and responsibilities, and men seemed more adrift. Does that square with your observations?
Yes, but I wanted to pick up on what the earlier caller, I think, was driving at, which is that gender roles are really different for people in their 20s and 30s. And so I think that the idea that your whole life is wrapped up with your career identity and who you are on the job, I think that that's certainly the case for the 50-year-old unemployed men that he was talking about. But it may be quite different for somebody who's 27, maybe they're got a part-time job, maybe they're going back to school to try to get a little bit more education or to get a certificate or some skills, and they're doing a number of different things, and so their identities are, you know, gender roles mm-hmm. are certainly not equal, but they're much more fluid in the younger generation.
You're nodding your head, mm-hmm. Judith. Makes sense to you?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. But even though gender roles are different, I do think women might still feel slightly less judged if they're out of the labor market, especially if they have children. And that helps them go out into the world when they mm. are not employed and to do volunteer work, to take classes, to meet with friends. So there may be those kinds of differences,
sure.
But I absolutely agree with Jerry.
You have looked at and talked with the numbers of low-income women, and I think for the general public, they think, oh, there's welfare. You know, if you're poor, you can go on welfare. Welfare doesn't exist the way it used to in the past.
It really doesn't. The program has shrunk dramatically since the passage of welfare reform. There are now work requirements. There are time limits. People never treated welfare as a way of life. That's a very tiny minority of the welfare population that is on it for many years. But it's really no longer even possible to do that.
Well, there's TANF, right? Mm-hmm. Temporary assistance for needy families.
Right.
So that's, I guess, a stopgap.
That's cash assistance. That's what's time limited to 5 years over the course of the lifetime. Not at one time, but over one's lifetime, 60 months. There are also work requirements. It's state-based when those kick in. Many states, they kick in on day one. And so it's really not an alternative to employment.
But what we're seeing, and this came up earlier in the hour, Jerry, is this, that perhaps there are not enough jobs for everyone to go, you know, to go around for everyone. And if it's kind of a buyer's market, perhaps, or a supplier's market, and people are going to be working for $10 an hour, $20,000 a year. Okay, yes, that's some money. But still, we've got people that are just sort of stuck working and never actually getting ahead. And perhaps this is the working poor that we hear about.
I think there's still room for macroeconomic policies to stimulate the economy and to try to push for full employment. So during the 1990s, workers were making progress and doing better. When there's a sense that there's no job out there, it's hard to say, oh, I want all these specifics. I want a more flexible job. I want to be able to go home earlier. I want to be able to work at home one day a week. It's hard to demand a lot of things from your employer when everybody says, well, you're lucky to have a job at all.
And you feel like someone might be breathing over your neck to get that job.
So without getting into a long, complicated discussion of how we can improve the economy overall, I think that there's no reason that we can't have a busier economy. And that would draw a lot of the men who we were talking about earlier into the labor market. It would enable a lot of families where they're getting by on having one worker. It would enable them to get those two incomes back, which would enable them to feel more secure and to maybe save a little bit and to get ahead a little bit.
Because, Judith, I mean, to be working and never get ahead, I mean, the stress of that has just got to be enormous. And I'm thinking of the children as well.
Absolutely. And a lot of this work is not, we sort of have a philosophy that work makes one feel good, makes one feel pride. And that's certainly true. And the vast majority of the women I interviewed wanted to be employed. And all the survey data shows that mothers want to be employed. But low-income jobs in particular don't necessarily give you a lot of pride. Mm. People are sort of scolded like children. The hours are long, or they're not long enough, so you can't piece it together and make enough income to hold body and soul together. And a lot of work is very menial. So it is hard to it's a real testament to low-income workers that they find pride and meaning in their work despite these conditions.
And, Jerry, you talked about the stresses of more, I guess, professional or more well-paid workers as well. It's just there are a lot of demands on the job now.
Sure. There's been an effort since the 1980s to cut back the ranks of middle management. And so the idea is you have to get more done with fewer people. And I think across the board, there are technological changes. You're always available to your boss on your phone. And there's just greater expectations about productivity. There's a sense that we're in a world economy. We got to keep up with competitors from everywhere. And I've been talking to people at different companies, and those kind of stresses are clearly, accumulate over time.
So is this, we should just get used to this? This is the world of work. This is the world that we live in, and this is the world that our children will be living in as well?
But it doesn't have to be that way. There are other companies that make it a point to say, let's focus on results. Let's make it a results-oriented workplace. Let's set limits on the demands that we put on people. And that enables people to come back to work more refreshed and less preoccupied with the rest of their lives. And so we can have a productive, high-wage economy where work is an important part of life, but not consuming of all of life.
Do you share his optimism, his perspective, Judith?
I do. I think that a lot of people are talking about this. A lot of people sort of feel like we're on the breaking point. And as employers are trying to attract the most attractive employees, this may be the issue that is best for attracting people. But I think there was a tempered optimism in Jerry's comment, and I share that.
the tempered part. Do you think there is still a perspective, though, Judith, that if you're a parent, if you're a mom, and you have a child, that's sort of your responsibility? I mean, it's, you know, you made the choice. Yeah, your life might be hard. Yeah, you'd like to be home for the soccer game or to meet with a teacher or something, but it's your choice.
Well, absolutely. Parents are responsible for their children, and the children didn't, you know, ask to be here. But I don't want to live in a society where we think only parents are responsible for their children, rather than we are all responsible for the children of the next generation. I mean, we will need workers, and we need to invest in them. So I don't want that to be just parents' responsibility.
Jerry?
I'd like to chime in there. Attitudes towards mothers of young children, attitudes towards their employment really depend on the circumstances. It depends on the kind of job she has. It depends on whether the family needs the income. And it depends on whether there's adequate quality child care.
Mm-hmm.
Once you take those factors into account, there's a lot of support for mothers of young children working. And conversely, when those factors are not in place, there's much less support for fathers working. There's a sense that this is a parenting issue as opposed to a mother's issue. Again, we're not in a world of equal gender roles, but my co-author Kathleen Gerson and I have been really struck by how much movement there's been in terms of re-understanding the role of parents of young children.
And the idea of a shared responsibility. Have you seen that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we do see an increase of men in time spent with their children and in doing the actual work of child rearing, of the diaper changing, of the sitting with the homework, and not just the fun stuff. But still, it certainly is unequal. We're not anywhere near equality at this point.
There was an editorial, I guess an op-ed, or in the Philadelphia Inquirer today, someone saying it's time for us to have pre-pre-K, so it would be kindergarten or pre-kindergarten for, 3- and 4-year-olds? I mean, would that help families, you think? If that becomes sort of part of the school calendar?
That would help low-income families enormously. And it's one of the few social policies that it clearly pays off. All of the data show that investment in early education has long-term effects on all sorts of outcomes for kids 20 years later. So it's a terrific policy for that reason, and it's a terrific policy for parents who are really struggling and cannot afford childcare.
We're almost out of time. I'm giving you the last word, Jerry.
In France, the École Maternelle is exactly that kind of setup. It's not stigmatized. Once you're 3 years old, and actually I think you have to be potty trained in order to drop your kids off there. It's kind of like elementary school.
Wow. And it really starts at age 3.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Jerry Jacobs, thanks so much. And he's a professor of sociology at the University of Pennsylvania, founding president of the Work and Family Researchers Network. Judith Levine, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Associate professor of sociology at Temple University, author of Ain't No Trust. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including podcasts and Facebook and Twitter and all sorts of good things. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.